Well, it's nice that we have a bit of silence, and I'm sorry to fill it quickly, but it strikes me that it fits well with the way I wanted to start my talk, which is to invite you to do a very brief visualization. So what I want to suggest is that you visualize the refuge tree. So that glorious array of beings with Bhante and his teachers on the front lotus, all the way up to the five jinnas and Vajrasattva at the top. On our left, the Bodhisattvas. On our right, the Arhants. The teachers of the past. The Dharma texts, and of course in the center, the Buddha, Dipankara, Maitreya. So this is where I started my reflections for this talk, and what I thought was that maybe we could just hold the refuge tree lightly in our imaginations somewhere. And then, in your own time, come back into the room. Just keeping a sense that the refuge tree is there. So at the center of the refuge tree is the Buddha, and the Buddha is our teacher, which is stating the obvious. So why do we vow loyalty to all of our teachers? I'm an avid Radio 3 listener, and during this week, one of the announcers said that a few years ago a student worked out that there were six steps between him and Mozart. And I was really surprised by that, only six. And of course it set me wondering how many steps there are between us and the Buddha. More than six, obviously. But each of these steps would be filled by teachers, starting with those close to us, our spiritual friends, our preceptors, and continuing with Bhante and his teachers and so on, back to the Buddha. And as I was writing this talk, the topic seemed to get bigger and bigger. The vow seems to encompass the whole of the spiritual path to me, just as the other vows do, perhaps more explicitly. So I think that loyalty to our teachers is a source of Shraddha, and it's an expression of Shraddha. And through it, we can learn to transcend our narrow, egotistical views. We can access the bodhicitta. So it's a gateway to liberation. So then, back down to a more mundane level, I googled loyalty, like you do, and I got this quote from Martin Luther. "Where the battle rages, there the loyalty of the soldier is proved." And what I like about that quote is that it encapsulates the sense that loyalty will be tested. So it's rather like faith. Faith is there because there's doubt. So perhaps loyalty is there because there's always the possibility of disloyalty. We have to continually decide to be loyal. And I found myself wondering whether loyalty was a bit easier for me than other people, maybe, because I really find going to new places and meeting new people very intimidating. So when I came here to North London 16 years ago to learn to meditate, I felt at home, and so I stuck. So I haven't regretted that. I haven't ever felt that it would be better elsewhere. But maybe for other people, looking around is a little bit more part of their way of being. And I thought also that loyalty to teachers is probably more challenging to us today than in the past, because I noticed when I was Googling something else that I got a Western Tibetan teacher that I'd never heard of. So within a few clicks, we can find new Buddhist schools and new teachers, and we can follow them online, can't we? So what will that mean for the future? Will it be harder to inspire people to remain loyal to one tradition, one lineage, and join our order? Thinking of the figures from the refuge tree, they made epic quests to go to for teachings and teachers. Like Xuanzang's walk to Nalanda or Atisha's voyage to Sumatra. It's a whole different order of magnitude from a few clicks or even a few hours in an aeroplane. So I've been rereading Bhante's memoirs in preparation for writing my talk, and I was struck by the sad story of the French nun Annie La, which some of you may remember. So she was ordained by Dado Rinpoche, but then she fell out with him. Bhante doesn't say why, but she ends up wandering the mountains of Sikkim on foot, contemplating suicide. She was so depressed. When she walks into a clearing, and there sits a lama in front of a tent, and this is Kachu Rinpoche, who's waiting for the auspicious day to enter the nearby monastery as abbot. And as she's in a nun's habit, he asks what her practice is. "I do the Manjugosha Sadhana," she says. "Oh no, you don't. You haven't done it for 6 months," he replied. Which is absolutely true, because when she fell out with Dado, she stopped doing the sadhana. So how amazing to stumble on a great incarnate lama by accident, who then shows you his power to read what's in your mind. And initially Annie La thinks the same, and so she goes to stay in the monastery and takes him as her guru. However, she's soon dissatisfied with him too. He spends too much time talking to his brother, who she considers a bad influence, and he uses alcohol in his rituals. Apparently, he sprinkled the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with whiskey, which I don't know about the whiskey, but the alcohol is a traditional Nyingma practice, apparently. So, unsurprisingly, Annie La doesn't manage to find a guru that she's able to be loyal to. And eventually, because of her increasingly outrageous behaviour, Dado Rinpoche reluctantly deprives her of her ordination. So we can contrast this with Bhante's own story. So he followed Jagdish Kashyap's instruction to stay in Kalimpong and work for the good of the Dharma. And he did this because he'd read in Thomas Merton that submitting to the will of your teacher is a way of transcending your ego. And looking back, he believed that Jagdish Kashyap had been able to foresee how it would benefit him being in Kalimpong when the great lamas went into exile. And these great lamas, they seem to have given Bhante teachings and initiations with such enthusiasm. I think it's Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, when Bhante asks him for an initiation, he offers him 4 or 5 or something. And these initiations, of course, have come down to us. And it's from that period of learning and devotion that Bhante had in Kalimpong that the order was born, and that's why we're here today. So in the lead up to ordination, as it was quite recent, it's fresh in my mind, but maybe, I don't know whether this happened to you, but I asked myself over and over whether this was what I really wanted to do. This Buddhist community, this order. And it was quite a troubled time to be in the lead up to ordination, and I received two or three phone calls from my private preceptor checking that I knew about all the things that were coming up. And I'm not going to talk a lot about that, just to say that my decision to stick, although I'm not talking much about it, it wasn't made lightly. It was quite painful to hear about these things, because we all want things to be perfect, don't we? But each time I returned to my understanding that loyalty to my teachers is by nature beyond what I can understand with my mundane consciousness. And I remind myself also that we're all, to a greater or lesser extent, driven by greed, hatred and delusion all the way up to enlightenment. But what I know is that my path has been illumined by something beyond, and that's what draws me on and inspires me. And this wouldn't have happened without teachers. So I've got a little quote which comes from 7-Point Mind Training, which my friend Hanka found, so I'm grateful to her for that. Without holding the paddles, the boat cannot cross to the other shore. Even if all other conditions are present, without a teacher's presence, the end is not reached. So then I reflected on the role of teachers in my journey, and many of you already know that my name, Maitri Sambhava, born from loving kindness, comes from the experience I had that first Tuesday evening when I came to North London to learn to meditate, and Lalita Raja taught me the Metta Bhavana. And I remember he taught me posture, and I remember ignoring everything he said, and of course he taught me the stages. But what was much more significant was that in the last stage of the practice, I had this glimpse of something else, something that I couldn't comprehend. It was a way of being that was much more positive than I was capable of. And it's that glimpse that ignited Shraddhar in me, and that's what still draws me on. And then moving forward some years, I'm at Tiruknalloka, and I was introduced to the refuge tree. And at a mundane level to Western rational materialist culture, it seems a bit bonkers, doesn't it? But at another level, I found that it was like coming home to something I already knew. And I was particularly excited by the teachers of the past. They appeared to come alive and chuckle down knowingly at me and my struggles. And there were a pivotal point in my ordination process was the Bodhisattva Ideal Retreat. And on that retreat, the moment I stepped out of the taxi, I felt I was in a mythic realm. And everything that happened seemed to acquire mythic dimensions. And I had a pattern when I went on retreat at Tiruknalloka that I would get into a mental and emotional tangle about something, a real tiz. It would be something I'd said or something that had happened in the kitchen or something that the group leader had said that I thought applied to me, but of course it turned out it actually didn't at all, usually. But what happened on this retreat was that after a while I realised there was an energy coming from the stupa which hit me in my heart centre, and every time I started to get into a tiz, this energy would vibrate and my tiz would sort of dissolve. And it was just completely astonishing. And what I after that, I mean, I wouldn't say I don't get into mental and emotional tangles anymore, but I didn't get into them at Tirunelveli. So I really felt that I received a teaching, and the retreat was based on Dado Rinpoche, which begins to make more sense of my experience. And it was so simple, this learning, that I laughed out loud. And it happened several times during the retreat. So what I learned then is that teaching from the enlightened mind isn't constrained by the usual considerations of time and space. So a year later, I'm on the Mythic Context retreat. Lots happened in that retreat, but I'm only going to talk about one thing. And I was on a journey with the refuge tree practice. I'd spent some time, the Buddha had always been a vague golden blur. So I had spent some time working on my devotion to the Buddha, and for a long time all I saw was the bowl and the lotus. But on this retreat, one of the things that happened was that that front lotus came towards me as if it was coming to meet me, and I felt literally like Bhante and his teachers were moving towards me as I tried to move towards them. So in that period before ordination, when I was being questioned on my response to the troubles, these two learnings were what I leaned on. They were what gave me confidence. So I look up to the refuge tree, and I know that each of those historical teachers reached liberation through their own endeavours and with the help of their own teachers, and their feats of endurance, determination and Shraddha, they're an inspiration to me. But more than that, I realise that I trust them. I trust that they reached liberation through this path, and so then I know that if I have their level of determination and devotion and resolve and faith, that I could do the same. So we can't necessarily, well, speaking for myself anyway, just connect with the perfection of our ideal directly. We need teachers closer to us to help us transcend our narrow and limited egocentric mundane consciousness. So loyalty to our teachers does help us get out of our own way, and it helps us to connect with the stream of the bodhicitta flowing from the refuge tree. And the process will continue, I'm sure. The day before my private ceremony in September, when we were meditating, I was daydreaming, and I imagined going to the Kuti, and not knowing what it was like, I imagined a white tent, a beautiful white tent with prayer flags around it. And I went to the tent and I lifted the flap, and there sat my private preceptor dressed as White Tara, my Yitta, with the crown and the earrings. And it was so astonishing. I was jolted back into the shrine room. And when I spoke to her about it, she just said, matter-of-factly, well, I've been doing the practice, haven't I, in preparation for your ordination. So I liked this acceptance that this is the way things work, I suppose. And I'm really inspired now by the stories of Bhante asking questions of the Buddha in deep meditative states, or Atisha and his dialogue with Maitreya in deep meditation. So that tells me that I'm going to learn a lot from my Yidam, but it's early days. I know she's teaching me a lot, but I have a very limited understanding so far, and I have a way to go. And in rereading Bhante's memoirs, I noticed that he began teaching so quickly after he arrived in Kalimpong. And this was particularly struck me because I've been beginning to teach since ordination, and I was surprised at how challenged I felt by stepping up and how sensitive I felt to some sort of feeling of responsibility I have about it, and even the language I use speaking to people who've just arrived at the centre. And even if we don't teach in front of a class or a study group, we are teachers because we exemplify, and we probably all remember at the beginning when we first met Ord members, where they struck us as being a bit different and we wanted to be more like that. So we all become teachers when we join the order, and we're spiritual friends, preceptors, whatever. And eventually we step into the stream of white light coming from the refuge tree, and we become part of our lineage, and we allow the light of the bodhicitta to pass through us and on out to all beings. So just to finish, perhaps we should dissolve the tree. I don't know. They always say that's really important, don't they? But on the other hand, this is a day of practice, and we've already called many of these great figures to mind in the puja, but we could just dissolve it or just sit quietly if you'd rather leave it there.